This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at how artificial intelligence and democracy are colliding in ways that could either strengthen self-government or quietly undermine it.
Our guest, Nathan E. Sanders, co-author of Rewiring Democracy, will explore how AI is already shaping politics, governance, and civic life.
The Constitution was built on a simple idea: divide power or lose liberty. But our own Steve Rohde argues that those guardrails are being dismantled in real time.
In my recent article, The Unitary Presidency, I warn that an aggressive theory of executive power, enabled by the Supreme Court's shadow docket, is systematically consolidating authority in the White House and redefining American democracy.
Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
Artificial intelligence and democracy are two of the most charged words in the news right now. To hear the headlines tell it, AI is either about to save us or quietly break everything that makes self-government possible. A new book refuses that false choice. It asks a more uncomfortable and more political question: who is using AI, how, and for whose benefit? The book is Rewiring Democracy: How AI Will Transform Our Politics, Government, and Citizenship, published by MIT Press. It starts from a deceptively simple idea. Democracy is an information processing system, one that gathers people's preferences and turns them into law, policy, and power. Instead of treating AI as a distant sci-fi threat, Rewiring Democracy looks at what's already happening: AI in lawmaking, courts, elections, public services, and everyday citizenship. And it asks the question too often left out of the debate: not what the technology can do, but who controls it and who is left out. Joining us today is Nathan E. Sanders, a data scientist affiliated with Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. His work focuses on using technology to strengthen democratic participation, especially for communities historically excluded from decision-making. He's the co-author of Rewiring Democracy, along with cybersecurity expert Bruce Schneier. Nathan, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much. Fantastic to be with you.
You and Bruce Schneier began writing together around 2020, when many of the political uses of AI still felt hypothetical. As you worked, what surprised you most about how fast those what-ifs became real-world political tools?
You're exactly right. When we started work on this subject, it was years before large language models were in the common parlance. It was years before ChatGPT was released. And to be frank with you, a lot of the feedback that we got from academic journal reviewers is that the applications of AI to politics and to policymaking that we were talking about felt unrealistic or outlandish. And it does feel 5 years later like there are real examples of those types of interventions leveraging AI happening in democratic systems all around the world. For me, the kind of wake-up moment was within just a few weeks of when ChatGPT was released. Bruce and I had just authored at that time an op-ed for the New York Times talking about the ways that lobbyists might use AI to supercharge their influence of political systems. And the Times, I think for the first time, published a response to our op-ed that was authored by ChatGPT. And that felt like a moment where it felt very real and very visible for everybody around the world that AI was now part of political processes.
Nathan, one of your most interesting core arguments is that AI isn't inherently democratic or authoritarian. It amplifies whatever power structures already exist. Can you expand on that for our listeners? Why are governance, ownership, and control more consequential than the technical breakthroughs themselves?
I do think that's right. We see AI as a power-amplifying technology, and our democratic systems have many actors within them. We have politicians vying for office. We have elected officials who are using their power in those seats of power. We have individual citizens and advocacy organizations fighting for what they believe in. And we can already see all those actors in political systems leveraging AI to amplify their own power, which is entirely natural in how all other technologies get distributed across these political systems. Now, there are, unfortunately, ways that those political actors can use AI for ends that at least I would find inappropriate. An example of this is the dichotomy between governments that may use AI to legitimately drive the efficiency and the ability and the capacity of their agencies to deliver services to people versus governments that may use that same AI technology in order to force a point of view, a policy perspective to be adhered to uniformly throughout a bureaucracy, even if it does not serve the interests of the people or reflect the will of the people. You know, I'm just going to mention at this point the example in the United States of Doge, Elon Musk's project within the second Trump administration. Depending on your political point of view, you may see that as a positive or a negative example of what I just described, but I suspect most of your listeners can identify it strongly somewhere along that spectrum. And that's the dichotomy that's facing governments and other political actors in using AI around the world.
Nathan, you're clearly trying to reach readers across the spectrum. Those who are alarmed by AI, those optimistic about it, and the many people who haven't really paid much attention to it yet. What do you most hope each group understands about the political stakes of artificial intelligence?
It's a great question, and I think you're right to call out that spectrum between what are often called AI optimists or accelerationists who have a firm belief in the power of the technology and see its potential benefits for society, and what are sometimes called AI pessimists or doomers. So ultimately in our book, Rewiring Democracy, we try and call out some of the very near-term applications of AI that are starting to happen in democracies around the world, and how, if they're steered correctly, they really could lead to positive benefits for society, like government becoming more accessible, making it easier for people to express their points of views on the issues they care about to policymakers, especially across language barriers using machine translation, as well as how those same technologies may be steered in a negative direction that actually restricts people's power, that amplifies the power of those who are best positioned to take advantage of new technologies, which are often the wealthiest, and those at large corporations. And we try and call out that whole range of outcomes so that we collectively as a society can steer towards the outcomes that we as citizens of democracies view as most beneficial.
To amplify that last answer, do you have specific examples on each end of the spectrum, either from our country or other countries?
Yes, let me share with you an example that we're writing about right now, and it's actually an update to a story that we tell in the book. At the time that we locked the text of our book, we wrote about a Japanese political candidate named Takahiro Ano, who at the time had just run in a race for governor of Tokyo. And he did this in a very non-traditional way. He was not affiliated with an established Japanese political party. He was, I think at the time, a 33-year-old software engineer. But he had a really powerful vision of participatory democracy, trying to engage constituents directly in helping to steer his own policy positions and the positions of the government. And so in the Tokyo governor's race, he used for the first time some really novel AI technologies to help him communicate his political platform. He did that by live streaming an AI-generated voice, an avatar of himself, for weeks continuously. And constituents, voters in Tokyo, could log on to this live stream and ask questions and hear his answers and offer feedback. And he's evolved that system into a formal way for people to see how their input corresponds to his policy platform. Where does it agree? Where does it disagree? And for that to be translated to him as a choice. Will he update his policy platform to align with that feedback, or is that not his vision? And for then voters to see his response. Did he adopt what they suggested or not? Now, he didn't win that Tokyo governor's race, although he won 150,000 votes, which is unprecedented for a new candidate of his kind. But then since our book has been published, he has now been elected to the Japanese Diet, the national legislature. He's now in the upper chamber there, so he's sort of the equivalent of a U.S. senator. And he's continuing to innovate in these deliberative technologies for democracy. He's actually leveraging the funding that Japan provides to him as the leader of a Japanese political party now. He's using that funding to hire engineers and to build open source tools that all Japanese political parties can use to engage with their constituents. We don't see anything quite like that happening in the U.S. today, but I think it's a suggestion of how political parties and organizers can leverage AI to build their power and to make democracy meaningfully more responsive to constituents.
That's a fascinating example, Nathan. You also write about AI increasing the bandwidth between legislators and constituents, making democratic participation more accessible across languages, literacy levels, and time constraints. What could that look like in practice? Where's the most promising experimentation happening now, in addition to your example about Japan?
So that's right. We write about democracy as an information system. We sort of analyze democratic governance as a way for exchanging information, information between voters and candidates, information between constituents and lawmakers and the agencies that implement law and courts as well. And because democracy is an information system, new information processing and communication technologies like AI have a very ready impact. Let me give you an example from the United States that I'm directly involved in. Here in Massachusetts, we have a civic technology project built by volunteers called MAPLE, the Massachusetts Platform for Legislative Engagement. And it's a free-to-use online web platform that's really targeted at increasing the information bandwidth between our state legislature and all of us who live in Massachusetts. So the way it works is that we've pulled in information on all 8,000-plus bills that are in the legislature right now, and we leverage AI as an assistive tool to help people understand what those bills do and to contextualize it for in terms of their lives. So for example, we generate plain language summaries so that constituents don't have to read through the legalese of a bill to understand what it would do. And then ultimately, the function of the website is to facilitate constituents to share testimony back to the legislature, to have their voice heard. Our North Star is to make that process as easy as possible, to lower barriers to policymaking participation across all the communities in Massachusetts. We think technology doesn't solve the problem of making government responsive and making lawmakers responsive to their constituents, but we think it's a really important aspect of increasing that information bandwidth. And we think that's at least part of the problem of making democracy more responsive.
Let's look at the other side of the coin. You emphasize, of course, that AI can deepen inequality, centralizing power, reinforcing bias, widening political access gaps. What do you and Bruce see as the most urgent risks that democracies are underestimating right now?
I see the most urgent risk, you know, maybe in the world today to democracy as the concentration of power in corporate hands. And it should escape no one's notice that the most valuable companies in the world today, maybe in the history of the world, and the ones that are, you know, so large that they're driving U.S. economic growth at a macro level, are a very small number of Silicon Valley tech companies like NVIDIA, Microsoft, and at a little bit of a smaller scale, AI startups like OpenAI and Anthropic. Maybe it doesn't make sense to call them startups anymore, that they have $100 billion market capitalizations in some case. But the concentration of so much wealth and power and influence over the tools that are increasingly being used in democratic and political contexts, I think is very worrying. And we do try and call out in the book that there are alternative systems that we can use. It is not necessarily the case. It does not have to be the case that AI development and the operation of AI systems is concentrated in the hands of a small number of companies. We have examples of other democracies around the world that are doing things meaningfully differently. Let me just give you briefly an example that we write about in the book, as well as one that's even newer. In the book, we write about Singapore, you know, a small Southeast nation state, doesn't have the wealth of some of these mega companies that we're talking about, but the Singapore government has invested in developing tailored large language models for use in governance. They have a project called Sea Lion that is developing LLMs that are specialized in Southeast Asian languages and targeted for use in government administration. And they've made them open source as a public good for anyone in Singapore or around the world to use. More recently, the government of Switzerland has invested in Swiss universities to develop a model called Apertus. This is now maybe the most powerful fully open source and democratically produced AI tool in the world. It's available for anybody to use, but created as a public AI tool, as a public good in Switzerland. This could be done by other governments around the world, at the state level in the US, other democracies worldwide, and we think it provides a valuable alternative to the corporate AI system that has concentrated so much wealth in so few hands.
So, Nathan, tell us a bit about your own background as a data scientist. What kinds of projects have you used AI for before turning to this book, and how did those experiences shape your thinking about power and governance?
Well, the thing I love about the field of data science and machine learning and AI is that it has become so interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary. There are a set of mathematical and software and AI tools that are so broadly useful in different disciplines. And I think that's reflected in my own background. I started in astrophysics. My PhD is in that field. My early research is really focused on astrophysical applications of statistical machine learning tools. But it was through service as a graduate student in the Massachusetts State Legislature as a science policy fellow there that I really became interested in democratic applications of data and of technology. So really the proudest accomplishment in my career is working with the environmental advocacy community here in Massachusetts to pass new government transparency laws that are now law in our state that require disclosure of sewage pollution into Massachusetts rivers and created a public database of that pollution, which we saw as a really valuable tool for communities to understand how they are burdened, especially burdened differently in an environmental justice context by that kind of a pollution. And it really showed me the power that data and the ability to analyze data can have on communities and on democratic processes. So I've worked in a lot of different fields since then, in public health, in the media and entertainment industry, in higher education. But really the through line for me is just the power of data and tools that analyze data to help communities, to help scientists, to help businesses answer questions and get things done.
Nathan, let's go back for a moment to talk about AI harms. Labor exploitation, environmental cost, extractive data practices that treat people as raw material. What responsibility do scientists, technologists, and researchers have in resisting those harms before we normalize them?
That's a great question. I want to talk about the harms themselves as well as the role for researchers individually and research institutions to play here. So there clearly are harms that are being created today around the world by the way we are practicing the development and operation of AI, and you just called out great examples of that, treating people as resources in terms of exploiting labor, often in the global south, to develop the raw data products that have been used to train so much of current AI models and to quote-unquote align them, the exploitation of mineral and energy resources, often extracted from specific communities that are not benefiting from AI at the level of the companies that are doing the exploitation. That is not a sustainable system. It's not a system that creates broad benefit. And again, it could be done differently. It's not a feature of the technology that it has to be built that way, that it has to be built with such energy and intensivity focused on so few communities. One of the directions that I think is really valuable is the development of cooperative data and compute centers owned by communities, capturing the value produced by the data and the use of AI in those communities, and with community governance over where that compute is located, how the energy is used, and how it competes, or maybe should compete less, with household usage of energy and those resources. So I really urge institutions to think about other ways of developing and deploying AI that doesn't extract all that value to a small number of corporations. With respect to researchers and research institutions, I think it's very important for us to call out in our own research how we're taking into consideration those factors, what we're doing to mitigate them, or what we feel like perhaps we can't do to mitigate them, and how the ecosystem around us should be shaped differently to do so. I think research institutions should resist the idea that the research that they create is purely for the extraction of private companies to advance their own interests in deploying AI. I think researchers should be explicitly thinking about creating tools that are in the public interest, that create public benefit, and that are aligned to the needs of communities. I think participatory research that involves communities in the development and deployment of these AI capabilities is maybe the most important way to do that.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Heidi Boghossian, and with my co-host Stephen Rohde, we're speaking with data scientist and author Nathan Sanders.
Nathan, let's dig deeper into your last answer. How does AI show up in your daily work? Where do you draw the line? I was so struck by your decision not to use AI to write your book. What informed that choice?
Well, it's a great question. It's true. We did not use AI to author any of the words in our book. And for both Bruce and I, that was very important. We wanted to make sure that we were presenting our own perspective as human authors and that we were very clear and taking accountability for that to our readers. That said, like most of us probably, I do encounter AI very frequently in my daily life now, and I look for the uses of it that make my work better and the service that I try and do for my institution here at Harvard and for my community better. I'll give you an example that I think about a lot right now. We draw in our book, I think, hundreds of international examples from around the world, and it has become so much more effective for me to learn about those international examples as machine translation capabilities have increased. I now have more direct access to be able to understand information published by governments around the world that are in languages that I don't speak by using these tools. And of course, they're not perfect, but I see in my own work and for my own research huge value to having that first pass of translation so readily available. It makes me much wider in my scope and focus of research than I could be otherwise.
Nathan, let's turn to policy. What does the European Union's AI Act get right? And what lessons should the United States lawmakers take from it as they continue to debate about how to regulate AI?
Great question. Of course, the EU AI Act is large and complex and really still evolving, even after having been passed and now being in the implementation stage. There's a lot of ongoing debate about what it should look like on the ground and how European agencies should operate it. So I want to recognize all that complexity. But at a higher level, what I think it gets right is that it is taking action to align the AI ecosystem with the public interest as represented by the European Union and on behalf of the citizens of the European Union. I think it's really important for governments to shape ecosystems, to shape industries for public benefit. And I see the EU really earnestly trying to do that. Now, I think there are lots of places, including some specific examples that we call out in our book, of where they might do that in a way that is stronger or more aggressive. And equally, I think that our collective point of view as democracies on what that shaping should look like will change over time. So the thing I most admire about the EU is that they've taken that action, they've shown the foresight to set up that governance platform, and now in the implementation stage have the ability to fine-tune that with public input. And unfortunately, I don't see that happening in the US today, particularly at the federal level. Unfortunately, the debate happening in the administration right now, not about how to regulate AI, but rather whether US governments should be able to regulate AI. It has been promised by the Trump administration this week that they would release an executive order that would provide a moratorium, a ban on state legislatures from governing AI. And I really think that's a terrible policy idea. That suggests that it is the AI companies that should be in control of how AI shapes our lives instead of our own elected representatives. There are states, such as most prominently California, that have taken some action to regulate AI, maybe not as comprehensive as the European Union, but for the federal government to overturn that will of the voters and to throw that out, I think would be inexcusable.
Nathan, if listeners walk away with one organizing question they should ask about any AI system, whether as citizens, voters, policymakers, users, what do you want that question to be?
That's a great question. You know, I'm guessing most listeners of this show have some strongly held convictions about democracy and about how their government should work. And I hope they will see AI as one of a suite of tools that they can use to make their voice heard on that subject, to influence the way our democracy operates, and to represent their values in the world. One of the things that I worry about is emerging disparities in how new technologies are leveraged, who has access to them, the so-called digital divide. And I hope that as AI, I think, increasingly does amplify the power of individuals, that we're not leaving out entire communities, either because they don't have access to those technologies and capabilities, or because they're choosing not to use them for any number of reasons. I hope people who see an opportunity to do good in the world by leveraging technology will take advantage of it. And I hope that we can also find ways to constrain some of the very serious harms that we've talked about today, like concentration of power that AI is currently producing, which is maybe its biggest impact today. I think we can constrain that, but it requires democratic action. And so I so appreciate you putting a spotlight on these issues in our conversation.
Nathan, before we let you go, I have two short questions to add. One is a remark, basically, that the United States itself doesn't have a federal privacy law. And I wonder if you still have hope that we might get an AI regulation legislation in, given that we don't even have one. We have a patchwork of privacy laws across all the states. And my second question is one that we hear a lot from people, a concern that we're going to lose jobs, that humans will be replaced. And it's not really the topic of your book, but if you could briefly address that.
Yes. First of all, I recognize that we have a lot of policy failures in the United States, in my point of view, especially at the national level. And one of them, I completely agree with you, is that we haven't updated our privacy law. We don't have a comprehensive privacy law that addresses digital and online technologies. It is decades overdue. It has caused, I think, great harm in how the internet has rolled out to Americans, how social media has rolled out to Americans. And it is now causing, it is now compounding that harm in how AI is being rolled out. And I think that urgently needs to be addressed. I am an optimist about democracy. I recognize that it's a system that gives us, all of us, a power to make things different in the future than they have been in the past. And so I hope that the risks produced by AI are a motivating factor for all of us to mobilize around this issue, the consumer data privacy issue, as well as some of the issues of democratic influence that we've also talked about today, to take action and to put some of those policies into place. It is possible. And your second question about job loss due to AI, I think clearly AI, like previous technologies, will influence the job market. It will influence how different skills are valued in ways that probably look pretty different than how other recent technological innovations like social media and the internet did. And here again, I think there's a role for government representing all of us to help shape those markets, to help support those who may be impacted by job losses, to help make sure we as a society invest in those skills and industries that we think are important to our national identity, to our national security, to our national culture, and don't allow important functions of human flourishing to be lost due to technological change, but rather support people through that change.
Nathan, this has been fascinating. We're so excited about your new book. Congratulations. How can our listeners follow your work?
Thank you so much for letting me join in conversation with you today. Our book is now out through MIT Press and available everywhere, and my writing is collected at my website, nsanders.me.
Well, Nathan, thank you so much. We want to stay abreast of your work and wish you the best for the upcoming holidays.
Likewise, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The American system of democracy was built on a simple, stubborn idea. Power must be divided if liberty is going to survive. James Madison warned that concentrating legislative, executive, and judicial authority in the same hands is, quote, the very definition of tyranny. George Washington cautioned that power's abuse is as predictable as gravity. Those weren't poetic lines. They were the operating instructions for a constitutional democracy. Our own co-host Stephen Rohde argues that those instructions are being ignored in plain sight. In his article, The Unitary Presidency, Trump's Second Term, the Supreme Court, and the Consolidation of Power, just published in Los Angeles Lawyer magazine, Steve says we're not dealing with isolated controversies. We're watching a sustained push to consolidate authority in the presidency, backed by legal theory, executive machinery, and a political ecosystem willing to treat norms and limits as optional. Steve traces how an extreme version of the unitary executive theory has become the rationale for purges of independent agencies, mass removals of officials, and executive actions that pressure universities, law firms, immigrants, protesters, and the press. In his account, the point isn't just what's being done, it's the precedent being set, that the president can control, punish, and dismantle without meaningful restraint. And the most alarming part, Steve argues, is the Supreme Court's role, especially through its emergency shadow docket, where constitutional decisions can be issued at lightning speed, often without full briefing or transparent reasoning. He asks readers, are we witnessing a temporary political lurch or a lasting constitutional redesign, one that leaves checks and balances as a ceremonial relic? Steve Rohde is a retired constitutional attorney, lecturer, writer, and political activist. He's the chair emeritus of several organizations, including Bend the Arc, the ACLU Foundation of Southern California, and Death Penalty Focus. He's also a founder and current chair of Interfaith Communities United for Peace and Justice, and he's the author of American Words of Freedom and Freedom of Assembly. Stephen, welcome back to the guest seat.
Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be in this position with you, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
You open your article by saying that we are in a constitutional crisis. Now, for listeners who hear that phrase often, what makes this moment fundamentally different from past periods of executive overreach or political polarization?
I thought long and hard about that phrase. It is the opening sentence of this article we're looking at today, and I believe it. For now, 11 months of this second Trump administration, in the beginning, people warned against a constitutional crisis. They worried about the oncoming constitutional crisis. But I've concluded, studying this whole period and everything that Trump and his cohorts have done, that we are in a constitutional crisis. And that's because the founders had a different idea about how this government should operate. The whole notion of separation of powers, of checks and balances, are not just cliches from a high school civics class. The founders came out of a period of monarchy, of kings, of the concentration of power in a single man, a single family, a single group. And they conceived of a different kind of government. They worried about the accumulation of power in the same hands. And now, today, not only are all three branches of our government, our federal government, under the control of a single political party, they are acting in service to a single individual, Donald J. Trump. I think the founders' worst fears have become a reality, not simply because of all this concentration of power, but because that power is being weaponized to retaliate against the opposing political party and other perceived foes. So it is a constitutional crisis. A crisis is when the structure of the very government that the Constitution created is being violated and is being wrought asunder. And I think it presents a very dangerous moment for our freedoms and our constitutional democracy.
The unitary executive theory is central to your argument. Can you explain how this theory has evolved, initially from a fringe legal idea to a governing doctrine, and why Trump's second term represents its most extreme application?
Yes. You know, I wrote the article, and I'm glad to be doing interviews like this because Americans have to understand what they're up against. Sometimes it sounds like a arcane legal theory, a unitary executive theory, but it's being implemented right before our eyes. Early in the Reagan administration, a group of law professors. One of them was Robert Bork, that many of us remember as his failed effort to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. But he and other law professors, and then the Federalist Society, which has dominated so much of the Republican Party and now the Trump administrations, they conceived of this notion that the president was on the top of the entire federal government, that he was in control of the executive branch, that all power of the executive branch resided in a single person that had dominance over the entire executive branch, and that any impingement on that unitary power coming from Congress was unconstitutional. And so this theory was rejected by the courts. There was a case some years back where only Justice Antonin Scalia, an arch conservative, he was in dissent, the sole dissent, while Chief Justice William Rehnquist and Sandra Day O'Connor were in the majority rejecting this notion of the unitary executive theory. Well, if anything, the right wing and the authoritarian wing of the Republican Party are tenacious. So they moved to nominate conservative justices, and they have achieved a 6-member supermajority on the court. And now the unitary executive theory is in full control of that wing of the court. And I fear what is emerging is it will become the predominant judicial concept of the three branches of government.
Now, Stephen, your article, you document an extraordinary list of executive actions, mass firings, deportations, detentions, dismantling agencies, and even military actions without congressional authorization. At what point does unilateral executive action cross from aggressive governance into constitutional rupture?
I think it comes at a point, and in many ways we are at that point and have crossed that border. The Constitution placed Congress as the first article. The founders wanted the direct election, although the Senate election had to be amended, but now we have the direct election of congresspersons and senators. They wanted that branch. It was the closest branch to the people. They felt by elections every 2 years in the House of Representatives that our government would stay close to the people and therefore close to democracy. The president was placed in the second article and has very little powers aligned to that individual. In fact, there's a section of the second article that says the president may recommend laws to Congress and can make a State of the Union address every year. But the Constitution, when it does articulate what the duties of the president are, his duty, his or her someday duties, are to faithfully execute the laws. Execute, implement. It's the executive branch. It executes laws. That's the duty and responsibility of the president. And so in these executive orders that are so sweeping, I took the time in the article to list, I'd say, over 20 different initiatives, and each is cited to the executive order or the executive action in question, in which Trump has crossed those borders, and we'll talk about some of those. That is where he is not executing the laws that Congress has passed. He's violating the laws that Congress has passed. So that's why this robust, sweeping use of the Unitarian executive theory has now come full-blossomed. And it's so dangerous because it shows in real life, in real time, what a president unbounded by the limitations of the Constitution can actually do. That's why the executive orders are such a threat to our democracy.
Well, Congress appears largely absent in your account, not resisting, sometimes even enabling. Is this a failure of political will, institutional capture, fear, or something more structural about modern congressional power?
Yes, I think it's all of those and a combination of them. First of all, the Senate and House are in the grip of the same political party. They happen to be in the grip of a very threatening, coercive, and intimidating president who attacks his friends as well as his enemies, who threatens to primary any elected official that does not toe the line. So we have a compliant Congress right now that, can you imagine if through the election we had a democratically controlled Congress and a democratically controlled Senate, how different the last year would have been because of the congressional investigations, the enforcement of congressional acts, lawsuits. Many lawsuits in the past have been brought by members of Congress to push back on the executive branch. Instead, we have this compliant Congress, and we have them not only not resisting, but implementing the big, ugly bill, implementing other initiatives that Trump has put up, and then failing when Trump crosses the line by attacking the boats in the Caribbean Sea and in the Pacific. I understand now up to 90 people have been killed. There's no congressional investigation. There's no outcry. There are fledgling efforts at impeachment on the Democratic side. So we are in a perfect storm in which a compliant Congress is allowing a powerful president to do his bidding and a Supreme Court in the grip of a conservative majority.
So many have been lulled into complacency, unfortunately. Steve, a major focus of your piece is the Supreme Court's use of the shadow docket. Why is this procedural shift so dangerous, and how does it change the court's role from constitutional referee to executive accelerant?
Yes, you put it so well. There is in the Supreme Court rules an emergency docket. Now it's been called the shadow docket for many years because what the Supreme Court does takes place in the shadows, and I'll elaborate on that in a moment. It's right to have an emergency docket. I often mention the risk of executing innocent people. An execution is scheduled on a future date, days or weeks away. Legal issues have been raised, and they need to be fully litigated before the individual is executed. So you need the power of the court in the midst of litigation to stay that execution. What's happened is that the conservative majority single-handedly or multi-handedly has used, I'm going to call it the shadow docket. Now, let's understand what's happened. The Trump administration, and we've discussed this, has altered the status quo in sweeping ways across departments, agencies, government power, military power, and all the rest. Individuals, plaintiffs, have gone to court to restrain that disruption of the status quo. What the courts have done, and I'm proud of the lawyers and the courts, upwards of over close to 500 lawsuits have been filed against the Trump administration in the last 11 months, and over 270 injunctions have been granted. An injunction is intended to maintain the status quo, to keep everything as it was on January 19, the day before Trump was inaugurated the second time and allow the courts to fully and fairly litigate the claims and defenses in these lawsuits. What the Supreme Court has done, and that's the 6-member conservative majority only, they have tipped that on its head. They are now staying the injunctions and allowing Trump's disruption of the status quo to take effect. And for months, all kinds of areas of our government have been disrupted. People have been fired. They're on their way to dismantling the Department of Education and other initiatives. And that's been allowed to go forward because the conservative majority is giving Trump this period of time. Now, we don't know what will happen when those cases are fully litigated. And the reason it's called a shadow docket is it happens in the dark. And what we need, and I think we'll come to that, is we need cases to be in plain sight.
Stephen, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson compared recent shadow docket rulings to korematsu, warning that today's court is, quote, leaving less of a trace. What does it mean for democracy when constitutional decisions of enormous consequence are made without transparency or accountability?
Justice Jackson is so strong and outspoken, as have been Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor. The dissenting opinions they've rendered in all of these cases, and there are upwards of close to 20 times that the Supreme Court has issued these stays. It is so important, and I really encourage people to go to the Supreme Court website or any place and find the dissents. They're clear. They're easy to read. They're outspoken. They call out the majority for what it's doing. And when it comes to the shadow docket, what Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson has pointed out is that in the normal course, we have a case. It comes before the Supreme Court. Briefs are filed on the merits. Amicus briefs are filed on the merits. The court convenes conferences and then holds an oral argument in which the lawyers on both sides physically and personally come before the court in a public hearing that is then covered by the press and by the public. Then the court retires to its further conferences, decides on a majority and a minority and whether dissenting opinions. And then the opinions are published and they fully examine the issues and explain the court's meaning and understanding and precedent. This is all isn't happening now. None of that. Some of these shadow docket opinions are one paragraph doing nothing more than describing the procedural history and then announcing that a stay has been granted. Luckily, the dissenting opinions are the most extensive review of what's actually happening in those cases. This is a shameful example of the control the majority has. It's no wonder the Supreme Court is in disrepute and in some of its lowest public approval ratings ever, because the people need to know what happened and what this court is doing. Korematsu is mentioned because that was an open and shameful public opinion. It took decades for the court to revisit Korematsu and to reverse it. So this is why the very structure of the Supreme Court is being undermined. I think they will regret this. We can only wait as these cases this year and next year are heard on the merits, what will happen and how fully they will implement the unitary executive theory.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Heidi Boghossian, and I'm talking with our own co-host Stephen Rohde about his article, The Unitary President. Steve, you spend considerable time on the Supreme Court's unanimous decision in Humphrey's Executor and the long tradition of independent agencies. Why is the destruction of agency independence such a pivotal step toward authoritarian governance?
Well, it is dangerous, and I will expand on that, and I want to begin because I think our audience should know, I think many hear the name Korematsu, and they know what we're referring to. A less well-known case is Humphrey's executor versus the United States. So early on, and the Supreme Court has consistently and early on unanimously held that the president is bound by certain congressional limits, that his power is not unbounded. This comes up in the area of independent administrative agencies, such as the FTC, which we'll be talking about. But there's scores of agencies that deal with clean air, clean water, and safety, and all of the aspects of modern life. Well, the court, early agencies, the Congress held, and in the case of the FTC, they held that once commissioners had been appointed to the FTC, they could not be fired except for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. And in Humphrey's executor, it's a case going back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and ironically, it was FDR that was slapped down by the Supreme Court. So all of us are citing a case in which a Democratic president went too far. FDR didn't like this particular individual, William Humphrey, who was appointed by previous presidents to the FTC. So Franklin Delano Roosevelt fired him in 1933. Well, the man died, and his estate went to the Supreme Court eventually, and the Supreme Court unanimously held and upheld the provision that commissioners could only be fired for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office. That Humphrey's executor principle and precedent has held fast for almost 90 years, but it's now up for grabs. And it's very dangerous that the court would revisit a precedent of that kind, which has been followed by Democratic presidents, Republican presidents, courts that are in control of Democratic appointees and Republican appointees, all down through history to this moment. Stare decisis is the Latin term for respecting precedent. Unfortunately, this court, this activist conservative court, does not respect precedent. It didn't respect Roe v. Wade when it overturned that precedent. And I am very fearful it's about to overturn Humphrey's executor.
Steve, finally, your article ends with a call to action, invoking the League of Women Voters and the founders themselves. If courts in Congress are failing their checking functions, where does constitutional resistance now reside? The states, civil society, mass movements, or elsewhere?
I have written and said that these lawsuits are necessary but not sufficient. It is important that for these 11 months, lawyers, the legal system, and judges are fighting back. I can't imagine what this last 11 months would have been like without these court rulings, these injunctions, and the robust exercise of democratic muscles by public interest organizations and lawyers. But there was a case just argued last week called Slaughter. It's exactly what I've previewed. A commissioner at the FTC was fired for no cause, fought back. The Slaughter case was argued about 10 days ago, and reading the tea leaves among experts and observers of the court, it looked like the conservative majority, at least five judges and maybe six, will uphold the firing of Slaughter and may even overrule Humphrey's executor, transforming, diminishing the power of Congress, giving Trump robust, wide-open powers there and probably in other areas. Now, if our Supreme Court won't be the barrier to this kind of lawlessness, then it falls to the rest of us. And that's why I believe No King's Day, the work across the country of Indivisible, of other groups organizing, resisting, getting ready, elections, the special elections this last November, the midterm elections, the election in 2028. Supreme Court justices are appointed by presidents and approved by the Senate. It's a political process. So if we can win back these sources of power, stymie Trump in the last 2 years of his service or ill service, and then take back the White House, appoint Supreme Court justices who will turn back the unitary executive theory. All of that is in our hands. I mentioned the Constitution. It really begins with we the people. And we are the ones that have a responsibility to protect and defend this Constitution and democracy, and really it falls to every one of us.
Well said, Stephen. You've written a wonderfully educational and insightful article. I urge our listeners to read it. The title is The Unitary Presidency, Trump's Second Term, the Supreme Court, and the Consolidation of Power. It was just published in the Los Angeles Lawyer magazine. Is that available for anyone to access, Steve?
Yes, the LA Lawyer, and I'm very grateful to them. This was a long article. I encourage people to take a few sittings, but I did it because I wanted every issue to be examined. You can find it at Los Angeles Lawyer. And I'm also pleased my friends at LA Progressive have republished it, and you can find it there. I discovered much of my work is collected at Muckrake, and you can go there for this and other articles. And I'm so grateful, Heidi, today to give me the opportunity to talk about this with you.
Oh, Steve, we're so fortunate to have you among our ranks. Thanks for the public service you provide, and we'll stay tuned for more updates.
Thanks, Heidi. We'd also like to welcome new affiliate station Camera Radio, 101.3 FM in Ventura, California. Thank you for airing Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.